Imagine being the first person to ever send a payment over the internet. New things can be scary, and crypto is no different. It's new, but like the internet, it's also revolutionary. Making your first crypto trade feels easy with 24/7 support when you need it. Go to Kraken.com and see what crypto can be. Not investment advice. Crypto trading involves risk of loss. Cryptocurrency services are provided to U.S. and U.S. territory customers by Payward Ventures, Inc., PVI, DBA, Kraken. Visit PVI's disclosures at kraken.com/legal/disclosures.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Drugs, Addiction, and Recovery, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Emily Dufton, and today I'm talking to David Posen, whose new book, The Constitution of the War on Drugs, was just released. And I mean literally just released, like 3 days ago, by Oxford University Press. Dave is the Charles Keller Beekman Professor of Law at Columbia Law School in New York. And he's written dozens of articles, essays, and book chapters, while also teaching courses in constitutional law and law and philosophy. The Constitution of the War on Drugs is his first book, and I'm excited to talk with him about it today. Welcome to the show, Dave.
Thanks so much for having me on, Emily.
So before we get started on your book, I'd like to ask a bit about you, because this book seems like a bit of a departure from your previous writing. So while you've definitely written about the Constitution before, looking through your publications, I see articles on things like the search for an egalitarian First Amendment and anti-modalities, you know, not a lot about drugs. So how did you get into our strange little subfield?
Great question. It's true. I haven't written about drugs specifically before. I've written about other topics in constitutional law. What really brought me to this topic was the observation that a lot of the drug reform groups invoke themes and tropes like racial equality, individual liberty, and reasoned government decision-making that are the central tropes of American constitutional law. They're the key values and themes that we discuss in con law all the time, and yet none of those drug reform groups ever seem to invoke the Constitution. So I was drawn to that sense of a disconnect or an absence. You know, where is constitutional law in this social justice reform struggle that sounds in a lot of its, you know, key ideas, but nonetheless doesn't actually try to use the Constitution to pursue reform? So that drew me in. And then once I got going, I just got really excited about the more I learned about how constitutional law used to play a big role in drug reform conversations and wanted to figure out how it fell out of the picture.
I also get the sense you wrote this book because you are not a fan of the drug war. can you define the war on drugs for us? And can you tell us a bit about your feelings on it?
I take as a premise that the war on drugs has been a colossal moral and policy failure, however you measure failure. And that's not a particularly controversial point within the social science or legal literature, but it's more of a jumping off point for the inquiry into what happened on the constitutional side. What I try to sidestep getting into, you know, the precise details of how best to define the war on drugs, which, as you know well, historians debate, and try to say that what I'm really focused on punitive and prohibitionist approaches to drug control, that instead of trying to regulate potentially dangerous substances through education or age thresholds or licensing or through the medical profession, taxes, zoning, you know, what have you, they're doing it through criminal punishment. And so criminal punishment paired with prohibitions on personal use and consumption, as well as sale of drugs. That's this cluster of policies and the approach that that I try to address. And defined in that kind of expansive way, the war on drugs predates Reagan and Nixon, really starts in the early 1900s, but then escalates over the course of the 20th century and, until it's, you know, kind of fully militarized by the 1980s.
Right. You say some pretty damning things about this century-long escalation of this prohibitive and punitive approach to essentially illicit drug use, although of course we police licit drugs as well. But you say that the war has undermined core tenets of liberalism, from the right to self-rule to the protection of privacy to the freedom of religion. You argue that it costs billions of dollars. It breeds distrust for the government and the rule of law. And the most damning thing you say about it is that, you know, despite decades of battle, it hasn't succeeded, that the problem is getting worse.
Right. That's what I mean when I say the war on drugs has failed by any plausible definition of failure, because whether you're concerned about liberal values of personal freedom or autonomy or choice, or you're concerned about racial justice and equality, or you're concerned about mass incarceration, or you're concerned about public health and the safety of drug behaviors and the rates of dangerous drug behaviors, through any of those lenses, you should be appalled by what we've gotten out of our drug policies in recent decades. So it's kind of, it therefore invites questions about if this set of policies was so draconian, discriminatory, and counterproductive. How come law and constitutional law didn't do more to rein it in?
How come all of us haven't done more, right? Yeah, you have a great line,
Yes.
right? You have a great line that says, "In the war on drugs, the curves of callousness and stupidity intersect at their respective maxima," which is very well put. And also, I can see like the chart in my mind, and it's almost beautiful with these two curves yet intersecting and causing so much destruction, right? I mean, this has been a substantiated disaster. And yet, though, you also write that that war is starting to unravel, right? We can see this through the
Right.
legalization of cannabis and psychedelics, the open discussion and sometimes reversal of laws that were blatantly racist, like the 100-to-1 sentencing
Right.
disparity between crack and powder cocaine, and even Oregon's brief experiment with decriminalization. Could all be seen as what you call a cooling off period of the drug war as it enters into a new phase. So, could you tell us a bit more about what you mean by this?
Sure. And I'll say on your prior comment about it wasn't just constitutional law, it was all of us who failed to stop the war on drugs. I of course agree it was a policy failure first and foremost. But the book's contribution is to bring in the Constitution, because there's been a lot written about how the war on drugs was politically constructed, how did it survive in light of increasing evidence of its harms. But what's not been written about is the constitutional challenges and what they might have done and did do. Is that and in a country where, when we're fighting about civil liberties and civil rights, the Constitution's, you know, usually at the center of those struggles, but not here. On the question of, sorry, I lost my thread. Have we entered a new phase?
Yes. Yeah. But let's actually go with that, because that's a really interesting question, right? Like, you argue that a lot of the previous drug policy changes came from activists, mostly grassroots activists, who, yeah, they modeled their campaigns on those who came before them, right? Like civil rights activists, HIV/AIDS activists, international human rights. So they want to change laws, change opinions, change hearts and minds. But you argue that what's missing is this desire to change the Constitution, which is very different from how most other countries that have changed their draconian drug laws, most specifically regarding cannabis, but in other realms as well, they have actually changed their constitutions, like Uruguay or Canada, but America hasn't. So why not? What makes America unique in this particular way? Why don't we want to change the Constitution when it comes to drugs?
That's a big question and a hard one. I'll say almost all other countries, they haven't changed their constitution in the sense of rewriting it to protect drug rights. Only, I believe, Ecuador has done that explicitly. Instead, their judges have interpreted general rights language to protect drug users, language about autonomy, privacy, and the like. That's the kind of move that was available here too, because we have also recognized, you know, rights of liberty, privacy, equality, freedom from cruel and unusual punishment, freedom of religion, and so on, under our Constitution. And in the 1960s and 1970s, lawyers and reformers made precisely those arguments to the courts, got some traction, actually won a number of victories in the direction of liberalizing drug policy at the state and federal level. And then the book tells a story of how that kind of the rise and fall of drug rights litigation and tries to piece together what happened. The basic answer, really simplistically, to well, how come other courts around the world, across many continents, not primarily Latin America and Europe, but also we've seen some out of Africa and Asia, are using constitutional law to rein in the harshest drug laws. The main reason I think we're seeing that happen more abroad than here is the whole way in which other courts now do rights review is pretty different from how the U.S. courts do it. They do a lot more explicit balancing of, on the one hand, the claim to individual freedom, dignity, or whatever other constitutional value is being brought by the person challenging the law, as against the government's interest in sustaining its policy. And they're willing to look critically at whether the government's approach makes sense, even if the rights claim on the other side isn't necessarily the strongest or most compelling. And that has allowed courts abroad to determine that marijuana prohibitions in particular are so ineffective and excessive in many cases that they have to be outweighed. They have to be seen as outweighed by the claim to freedom or privacy on the other side. U.S. courts have been much less willing to do that kind of balancing. They look much more categorically and formalistically at rights. And that's part. There's also a lot of historical contingency and other factors, but that goes some way to explaining why the U.S. has actually fallen behind a lot of the rest of the world in recognizing any version of constitutional drug rights.
Well, so then what does our Constitution say about drug use?
Now, of course, nothing specifically, but there are a lot. The book tries to explain that there are a lot of clauses of the Constitution that plausibly bear on drug prohibition and that reformers have utilized to try to attack criminal drug laws in the past. And so those include the right to privacy that's been recognized under the Due Process Clause of the Constitution. That tends to be invoked when people want to possess or consume drugs in their own homes in private and say they should be spared, you know, state punishment for that. The Equal Protection Clause has been used for racial equality claims about the racist origins or effects of drug prohibitions. The Equal Protection Clause has also been interpreted by the court to ensure that criminal classifications are at least minimally rational. And that was used in the 70s to challenge marijuana's placement in the most restrictive drug schedules on the ground that that's just irrational. It really shouldn't be lumped together with heroin and heavy narcotics. And that kind of guarantee of reasonable, you know, government decision-making was grounded in the Equal Protection Clause. I'll be quick. The Eighth Amendment prohibits cruel and unusual punishment, and that's been invoked to challenge criminal punishments for being addicted to drugs and also just excessively harsh sentences relative to the gravity of a nonviolent drug offense. And then the First Amendment protects freedom of religion and speech. And both of those were utilized in the 60s and 70s to attack drug laws that were seen as undermining people's spirituality or religious practice, or in some cases their self-expression and political protest. So there's no shortage of pieces of the Constitution that may be used to attack drug laws, and which ones have been seen as more compelling have shifted over time.
Mm. And certainly we've used the Constitution to change our own policies over intoxicant use, too. We've done it twice with the implementation and then reversal of federal alcohol prohibition, right? The 18th and 21st Amendments. And what I like about them being number 18 and 21 is that it allows me to remember the two legal drinking ages in America.
I thought of that.
Right, because it used to be 18 and then it got moved to 21. So that's how you can remember both federal alcohol prohibitions amendment numbers and the legal drinking ages in America. So that's my hot tip for today.
You know, I'll just say on that the ratification of the 18th Amendment, bringing in alcohol prohibition, partly reflects how different constitutional law was at the time in the early 1900s, when some of the big questions about regulating drugs were whether any level of government, state or federal, had the authority to ban the possession, consumption, and distribution of these substances. And the question was, a lot of the questions were about government power. And by the time you get to the mid 20th century, where my book really picks up, those questions have been settled. The state and federal government are clearly understood by then to have the regulatory authority to ban drugs. That's no longer an active point of dispute. And the question then becomes one of rights. You know, people start asserting that they have, notwithstanding that the government has broad general authority to regulate and even ban dangerous products, nonetheless, I have a right to, you know, to certain behaviors. And so after the 21st Amendment, just to say, the constitutional debates take a new character. They're no longer about the limits of government power so much as about questions of individual right.
Right, understood. But then within that shifted sort of perspective, you know, from government power discussions to rights discussions, your book recovers, as you put it, a lost history of constitutional challenges to draconian drug laws, sort of based on that concept of rights. And in the late 1960s and early 1970s, you've already kind of touched on this. I mean, you had me at lost history because I love that stuff. But this is very intriguing, a lost history of constitutional challenges to drug laws. What's going on here?
It's I guess the book's a kind of anatomy of a failure. You know, there was this robust, vibrant, interesting constitutional movement in the 1960s and 70s to challenge drug prohibitions, and as I said, it scored a number of victories in state courts around the country and in lower federal courts, and then it fails by the time we get to the 1980s. So by the time Reagan takes over, the constitutional path is already paved for him to escalate and militarize drug enforcement. So the book kind of says that the real window of possibility in which we could have nipped the drug war in the bud. Is that a bad drug pun? I didn't mean to.
All puns are welcome here. That's fine.
Yeah. Or allow the bud to flourish or something. was in the 60s and 70s when drug politics were much more fluid. You have, for example, President Carter expressing explicit openness to decriminalizing marijuana, possibly cocaine as well. And you have the kind of a rights revolution taking off. New youth movements and Vietnam veterans who are supportive of drug liberalization. It's a complicated period with some political currents swirling in different directions. You have documented more than anyone, you know, the anti-marijuana parents movement and how that's rising at the same time and what that would go on to do. But the judges had some political room to maneuver, you might say, in the late 60s and 1970s around drugs. Given how many different establishment actors were supportive of liberalization. And constitutional doctrine was quite fluid in this period around a lot of these issues like privacy and equality claims. And so so it was kind of an exciting time to think about the constitutional limits on criminal drug regulation. And I'm describing, in a sense, a path not taken. Like what would have happened if those victories had been upheld and some form of drug rights had been recognized by the end of the 1970s, and you know kind of recovering a moment that's passed us by, but that I still think has lessons for the way common law developed and the way the drug war developed.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the late 1960s and early 1970s is such an important and really misunderstood time period in American drug history, because I think we all assume, you know, like the famous, you know, June 17th, 1971, Nixon launches the war on drugs, right, and everything is racist and awful and terrible. And it's like, well, actually, The war that he launched in 1971 was waged with methadone and treatment clinics. Heroin arrests went down that year. This is a very liberalizing moment for drug policy nationwide. As you talked about, marijuana decriminalization starts to spread from 73 to 78. You have a far greater emphasis on treatment and rehabilitation, a greater interest in allowing people to sort of avoid the criminal justice system for drug use, as opposed to kind of funneling people back in. I mean, this is a big reversal from the 1950s and early 60s when you had the Boggs Act and little Boggs Acts everywhere, where, I mean, the prisons were so full of nonviolent drug offenders that, you know, Washington, D.C. literally had to create a methadone program because their jails and prisons were bursting at the seams. I mean, it's a very, I think we misunderstand this liberalizing moment. And I hope that work like yours and hopefully my book, if I ever finish it, will help sort of round out these edges, because you're right. This is a zenith, and things like conversations start to shift. So tell us a bit more about some of the biggest actors in changing the narrative about drug users and trying to protect their rights in the courts as opposed to simply punishing them.
Yeah, there are a lot of actors I could bring in here. I guess I would say, in civil society, there are all kinds of groups who are speaking out in favor of marijuana decriminalization and sometimes broader drug decriminalization, from the American Bar Association and the American Medical Association to the Consumers Union to the National Council on Churches, National Council of Rabbis. All of those groups are supporting some version of decriminalization. So you have kind of elite establishment civil society groups weighing in that direction. You also have a number of government commissions in the U.S. and abroad that are putting out reports on drug abuse and particularly marijuana, all supporting a public health kind of medical response rather than a criminal legal response. And then you have in the courts and in the law specifically, the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws, NORML, founded in 1970, becomes the key litigator of challenges to marijuana laws. And the ACLU in the late 1960s gets in the game as well, and for a while is litigating actively in this space too. And so those are some of the key players we might mention. I'll just note that one thing that was different about the constitutional arguments you heard in the 60s and 70s, and like in prior periods, is that they questioned whether and under what conditions the government could criminally ban drugs in the first place. Nowadays, we still do have some active constitutional debates about drug issues, but they're all about procedure and enforcement. That is, just how aggressively are the police allowed to enforce the drug laws through things like surveillance and undercover informants, stop and frisk, questions of racial profiling. We have a lot of important, vigorous debates about the limits of enforcement of the drug laws. But I want to say in this book, those questions, as important as they are, they're all downstream from the first order question of, can the government criminalize your drug use in the first place? And with what kind of showing does it need to make? And for what kind of drugs? And with what kind of penalties? And that's what was on the table in the 1960s and 70s, the first order question of whether and when drugs could be prohibited at all. So I view us as having drifted away from the central questions here to tackle, which before we get to questions of how drug laws may be enforced, when can they be passed in the first place?
Right. So how did these groups, NORML and the ACLU, attack or question maybe that concept of, can the government criminalize this action at all? What was the basis for their arguments here?
They tended to build on the Warren Court's civil liberties decision. So the Warren Court is the Supreme Court when the Chief Justice is Earl Warren from early 1950s to the end of the 1960s. And it's this famously liberal period in the court's jurisprudence where it's delivering, landmark opinions on privacy, racial equality, and the like. And they, groups like NORML and the ACLU, realized that some of the key Warren Court precedents could be utilized to attack drug laws. For example, In 1965, the Supreme Court hands down Griswold versus Connecticut. And that opinion strikes down a ban on married couples using contraception in the home. So it's not about drugs, it's about kind of procreation and marital privacy. But there's a lot of general language about a right to privacy, and the home being a special sanctuary for one's the experience of one's privacy. And groups like Normal and ACU quickly figure out, ah, Griswold could be very useful. Privacy in the home, is the kind of claim we can mobilize for drugs as well, when there aren't clear harms to third parties. And so that's just one example. But basically, they are building on recent liberal egalitarian opinions from the Warren Court and trying to develop a new kind of drug rights jurisprudence out of them. They're not making the old arguments about how the state doesn't have the power to regulate drugs so much. They're making a new set of liberal arguments based on privacy, racial equality, and freedom of speech and religion above all.
So how did it work out?
Well, varied by issue. The general thrust is early successes, some potentially path-breaking, cases, some of which are still celebrated by drug reformers abroad, but then eventual failure. So, when it comes to the liberty and privacy claims, for example, as you know well and have written about, you get a few state Supreme Courts in the 1970s recognizing some form of a right to privacy that covers drugs. Most famously, the Alaska Supreme Court in 1975, Raven versus State, says that Alaskans, under both a provision of the state constitution that protects privacy and under Griswold, that case I just mentioned, and the federal constitutional protections for privacy, have a right to possess and use small amounts of marijuana personally in the home. And so that sticks, by the way. Alaska Raven is still good law in Alaska, and remains our kind of the canonical case from the American system on drug rights. But for the most part, in other states and at the federal level, courts redefine the test for what gets protected as a matter of substantive privacy and liberty to require that a fundamental privacy or liberty right be infringed. And courts are unwilling to find that smoking pot, is a fundamental right. It may have privacy and liberty dimensions to it, but they're not willing to go that far. And in fact, the very construction of that test, that to possibly win a privacy claim, you first need to establish that you've had a fundamental right abridged. That in part develops out of the drug cases where basically courts, as I tell it, start to get panicked that they've opened the floodgates to all manner of personal liberty claims after Griswold. And so they're searching for new tests and criteria to try to limit close up the floodgates. And partly the drug cases are where that battle plays out and where they try to preserve a space for paternalistic regulation. So that's the liberty privacy claims. I could go on with each area, but I'll just say in some ways, the most straightforward claims were the ones made under the Eighth Amendment, because that explicitly says no cruel and unusual punishment, and in some ways offered up the most straightforward set of arguments, which is that should be understood to require that the punishment fits the crime. And when you have non-trafficking, non-violent drug offenses landing people in prison for many years, that is grossly disproportionate to the, moral severity of the offense, and that made headway in a number of state courts too before the U.S. Supreme Court really closed down that line of argument. I offer that just as another example in a relatively straightforward one of where constitutional lawyers were attacking in the 70s.
Right. Yeah, in the end, you argue that this tidal wave was swept back to sea, and all of the successful constitutional challenges of the 60s and 70s were overturned or minimized or ignored. I mean, you call it a constitutional failure, which is obviously a bummer. But what's interesting to me is that, you know, it is certainly a part of the context of the moment, with courts being afraid, I guess, in post Griswold, that they've opened the floodgates to all kinds of private behavior being allowed. But you also say that it has something to do with protecting drug users themselves as basically a demographic, right? Because they're, rather than being discrete or insular, drug users are everywhere. Like, they're not like a community like the LGBTQ community or gun owners or whoever, you know, whatever lawyers are trying to protect, whomever lawyers are trying to protect. But you write that drug users are more difficult, I guess, in a way, to defend, because their use is still obviously highly stigmatized. But of course, they themselves are, as you put it, an anonymous and diffuse plurality of the population dispersed through all segments of society, poorly organized and largely in the closet. This is a difficult population to defend in court.
Well said. I'm lifting off from individual lines of legal doctrine. You know, what were the Eighth Amendment arguments? What were the First Amendment arguments? And I'm stepping back and saying, when do constitutional rights movements tend to succeed or fail? And there's a literature by constitutional scholars about that. And they, you know, some of those scholars say that one crucial feature of the successful constitutional rights movements of the 20th century were that they sought to protect what the court has called discrete and insular minorities. These are relatively cohesive and recognizable groups that share some social identity. And you can think of the movement for LGBTQ rights as very much fitting this model. It's often analyzed in that way. And some of the court's rights doctrines are specifically tied to recognizing the kind of identitarian claims of those groups. You know, we deserve equal treatment and don't want to be demeaned anymore. But what the other sort of group that tends to lose as a constitutional rights movement, the flip side of that story in this literature are the anonymous and diffuse groups who may actually have many more members, but they're not well organized. They don't have a strong sense of a shared identity or an affirmative argument for why they matter, you know, and deserve respect, and they're not organized in a way that allows for effective advocacy, and so that's how I see drug users, you know, in the 1960s and 70s. There are lots of them. There are tens of millions of them, but they are they're not really coming together as a cohesive coalition. And in fact, especially after Reagan takes office, they tend to stay in the closet. And instead, this kind of accommodation is worked out, where elites, mainly white, are spared the harshest punishment under our drug laws, while more disadvantaged people and people of color are more vulnerable. And this basically, the elites feel the situation is tolerable for them when it comes out of after the 1980s, and we get this kind of sad equilibrium, you know, where we chug on. But at this moment of possibility in the 60s and 70s, the story is really about how the drug rights movement never does what successful rights movements do, which is figure out how to tell us an affirmative story about what they're for. You know, not just why the government policies are bad, but what they're about, and develop some sense of a shared identity and purpose.
Well, this has had real implications, right? You write, since the zenith of the late 1960s and early 70s, constitutional law has helped to validate and entrench defective and destructive policies, which is not good. And you essentially argue that the outcome of constitutional support for a punitive drug war is that it has cost Americans their liberty, equality, and government rationality. I mean, what do we do with a situation like this? It seems like a bummer.
It's definitely a bummer. I think the role that the Constitution should play in fighting drug laws that are ineffective or and overly punitive is really complicated and hard. And I don't land on a very strong position there. I want to show that many different sorts of constitutional arguments against punitive drug laws are plausible, and that prior generations of Americans and certainly American lawyers understood that these constitutional arguments were plausible. So we should recover this sense of constitutional and not just policy discomfort with punitive drug laws. Now, what might it look like, though, to kind of operationalize that discomfort, you know, in a way that leads us to a better place? That could take a lot of forms. What I end up saying toward the end of the book is what's probably not going to work is trying to just revive the old arguments, you know, the old privacy arguments, the old free speech arguments. They've been closed off for the most part, and there's a lot of doctrine against them at this point. So I end up suggesting, but nonetheless, there are a whole new set of constitutional arguments that are now plausible, that could be tried. And in addition, constitutional arguments can be made outside of the courts and should be made outside of the courts and addressed to legislators and regulators. So it's not just that courts should recognize people's rights and strike down laws, but when, for example, the DEA is deciding what schedule to place marijuana in the current process of, you know, reviewing marijuana scheduling under the Controlled Substances Act, it should care that there are privacy, racial justice, free speech, freedom of religion, you know, implications to what it's doing. That should bear on the regulatory calculus. And also advocates and reformers, you know, outside of government, I think it's another arrow in their quiver to recognize that there's a long history of seeing punitive drug laws as constitutionally problematic, that they can tap into rhetorically, if not in litigation. And finally, I'll just say that while a lot of social justice and racial justice movements debate how much to turn to the courts and the Constitution in general, or whether that might be kind of unproductive or, you know, a waste of resources, or might, you know, de-radicalize their best arguments, here you have a situation where tens of thousands of people are being prosecuted for drug crimes every month. Whether or not you appeal to judges' constitutional consciences, they're going to have to resolve these claims. They're going to have to deal with these cases. So in that kind of situation where you have a million plus criminal cases per year, I don't think you have to really face the same hard choices that other movements do about whether or not to try to make the best constitutional arguments you can in court, because you're in court all the time, you know, again, like it or not. But as far as what the new constitutional arguments might look like that could be, could have a chance, at the end of the book, I'll just say briefly, I look in two main directions. One is backward in time toward originalism. And this is what the current Supreme Court purports to like to do when it interprets the Constitution, which is to ask how it was understood, how any given provision was understood at the time that it was written and ratified. And that may seem like a very inhospitable approach to drug rights. You know, surely the framers weren't thinking about drugs. But actually, there are quite a few moves you can make as an originalist that could support drug rights. For example, there's a lot of new historical scholarship about what the framers meant when they wrote the Eighth Amendment and the prohibition on cruel and unusual punishment in 1791. And some of that historical scholarship suggests they had a surprisingly expansive understanding of what was cruel and unusual. And that long prison terms for nonviolent offenses are quite plausibly cruel under the framers' understanding back in 1791. So you have there's just one example of an originalist argument that that is teed up, you know, ready to go from the academic literature. And then the other main direction I suggest we could go is looking not backward in time but abroad, and looking at what courts and other constitutional courts in other countries are doing. Doing what they call proportionality review, asking whether incursions on people's privacy, autonomy, and the like are proportionate to the government benefit. And through that analysis, finding some marijuana laws in particular to be unjustified. And although the U.S. federal courts haven't wanted to operate in that way, I suggest that a number of state Supreme Courts have actually gotten quite interested in proportionality, and so would be a good place to try out those arguments. So I still see room for constitutional attack on drug laws. It just may look different than what normal and ACLU were doing in the 1970s.
And it certainly seems like the time is ripe for such conversations, especially over the past 10, 12 years since recreational legalization of cannabis started taking off here in the US. And as we've continued to look abroad for solutions to the opioid crisis, it seems like there's a moment where American hearts and minds are slightly more open and receptive to slightly less draconian drug policies. Do you have any sense that constitutional law might be a place where activists look next? Maybe after they read your book, perhaps. I don't know.
I don't know. I mean, that would be great. I agree that we're in another moment of possibility for humane, evidence-based drug reform, rather than just dispensing harsh punishment. But I also view this moment as precarious, as fragile. One way to tell the history of American drug policy, as you know, is a story of racialized moral panics. That pop up in any given period and kind of set back drug policy, and then things cool off, and there's more momentum for liberalization, and then we get another panic. And so I do worry that we're about to hit another panic, or we're already on the cusp of another panic, although the racial dimensions are more complicated with opioids, certainly. And so one thing constitutional law can do is entrench reforms, at least for some period of time, against political rollback. So if it's right that there's a new recognition, at least among policymakers and academics and elites, that the drug war was a disaster, that's something I think constitutional law ought to capitalize on in the sense of, entrenching some barriers against the most destructive policies. That's abstract, but just to say why this might be, it might be useful to think about constitutional law in any moment when there are progressive possibilities. But I guess, while I don't think it's likely that, the Roberts Court is gonna recognize drug rights in any robust way, I think there's meaningful progress to be made at the state court level, as I was suggesting earlier. And again, by addressing constitutional arguments to Congress, the Justice Department, and the like. In a sense, that's almost the easier place to start, to bring in a new set of considerations, not just asking about potential for abuse or medical benefits and the very narrow conversations we have around drug regulation, but also asking about the privacy costs, the liberty costs, the equality costs, and so on. That I think is incumbent upon all government actors, not just courts, and actually in some ways an easier lift, because it's a big deal for courts to strike down legislation enacted by, elected representatives. But drug scheduling is something that has to be done year in and year out. And I, like many constitutional scholars, think that the courts have absolutely no monopoly on the Constitution, and it's for all actors of government to take these questions of rights seriously.
But isn't that precisely like the tricky waters that Americans specifically have to navigate? As you touched on before, there's a very, very big difference between, federal rulings and state rulings. There's different
Yeah.
policies in place on the federal level and state level. We can see this most clearly with marijuana legalization.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, there's something very tricky there when Pennsylvania says this, whereas the federal government says this, whereas Florida says this, whereas California says this. This is not how other countries have gone about their legalization practices, and it throws a lot of hurdles in our way for, I think, creating a comprehensive and ideally humane set of policies. How can constitutional
Yeah.
law scholars overcome these barriers?
So it's certainly true. Our federal system creates the hurdles you describe, but at the same time, it creates opportunities for experimentation, not just in terms of policy, but also in terms of constitutional law when it comes to drugs. So I think constitutional lawyers often talk about federalism as allowing for laboratories of experimentation, Justice Brandeis's famous quote. And I think we've actually seen that play out with marijuana policy, where states, you know, tried it first medically, then recreationally. Other states realized the sky didn't fall. This might be useful,
or a moneymaker.
And a moneymaker, and we've had, you know, policy diffusion and learning. That could happen too with courts and with constitutional law. It just hasn't so much in recent decades. What I mean by that is every state in the country has its own constitution. All of those constitutions have basically the same bundle of rights as the federal constitution and a whole bunch of others. And it is a universally embraced maxim of American law that state courts, when they're interpreting their own state constitutions, can depart from the way the federal court interprets the federal constitution, even when they're interpreting the same language. In other words, a state court could interpret its own due process clause or equal protection clause or guarantee against cruel and unusual punishment differently and more rights protectively than the federal courts do. And that is another kind of bounty of federalism that we should be trying to achieve. But state courts largely haven't been doing that in recent decades. They've done what constitutional scholars call lockstepping, usually just followed what the federal courts did, whether because it's easier or safer or they agree or for whatever set of reasons. So one thing the book tries to show is that state courts were creative in the 1960s and 70s around these issues. And some of them actually issued rulings on drug questions that hold up really well over time, look quite sensible. And foreign courts abroad have drawn on heavily as sources of guidance. So I think, although you're absolutely right, getting the most effective national policy is really hard and may require, you know, federal legislation, common law can usefully catalyze new approaches at the state level that everyone can then learn from.
So you've now written hundreds of pages about this. You've clearly been researching and studying this for years. Where do you come down at the end of the day? What do you think American drug policy should be as far as constitutional law is concerned?
So I try in my work not to say this is what the Constitution means. This is the truth of the matter. I don't view that as my role, really, as a scholar. I view that as the job of an advocate. So instead, I tend to try to say these are plausible arguments. Here are the costs and benefits of going this way, and offering, you know, kind of an analytic framework to think about the moves we might make here. So and this book has that character too. I'm not here to say you have a constitutional right to use drugs and it looks like this. I'm here to say it is plausible that there are various constitutional protections against draconian drug laws. You should know that and take those seriously. And that should inform our advocacy and our policymaking here. The one thing, and I also say at the end of the book, getting good drug policy right is really hard and probably requires a whole lot of public expenditure and social provision around health. You know, I don't think drug reform can really be done really effectively without significant public expenditure around promoting health and that's not something that courts or constitutional law can do on their own. So what I think we can hope for from common law is not so much developing a perfect or ideal drug policies, but we can fairly ask that they be a tool to fight the most horrible and cruel and punitive policies that are also ineffective. In other words, constitutional law and courts aren't good at a lot of things, like achieving good policies, but they are well structured to be a brake on overpunishment. That is one thing they're well set up to do. When you have excessive punishment that is serving no good public benefit and undermining people's rights in the process, that courts and common law are well suited to do. So that's kind of the way I frame how we should pursue here. On two tracks, constitutional law can help fight off the most discriminatory, the most destructive policies. But when it comes to seeking policies that really help people in need and deal with overlapping crises of lack of housing and poverty and mental health, as well as drug addiction, you know, that's not a task that courts or the Constitution can cover.
Right. I think that's a really important point, kind of highlighting the role that the courts and law continue. I think the contribution that they give to our larger understanding of drug policy and how it's created, how it's enacted, how it's enforced. And I wish that this book had been written when I was researching grassroots, because I learned a lot about the the state law changes for decriminalization that I mentioned in it. And I was like, oh, this is how that happened. That's amazing. So what was the inspiration for this book, and how did you go about researching it? Because I did a brief sort of a brief analysis of the bibliography, but it looks like this is the first book specifically about the Constitution's role in the drug war. So how did you come up with this idea?
You know, it's a little, I could tell different origin stories, and it's almost hard to reconstruct at this point. There's the point I made earlier about responding to a sense of absence. Like, where is the Constitution? It's on the sidelines of this major social justice struggle and civil liberties and civil rights struggle we're having right now. That America is often criticized for how we've constitutionalized every social issue. So I found it very strange that the Constitution, we had deconstitutionalized, you know, drugs when we fight constitutionally about everything else. So there was that, you know, kind of sense that there's something missing here. That was part of the motivation. More, I don't know, crudely, I just got invited to do a book for this series. It's called the Inalienable Rights series for Oxford University Press. And they're kind of meant to be shorter, more accessible books on constitutional rights topics. And this seemed to fit the bill, you know, for a kind of a rights topic that used to be talked about as an inalienable right to the pursuit of happiness that's fallen out of the picture. And then finally, on how I went about researching it, I ended up getting deep into the state cases in a way I've never really done before in my research. But a lot of the action, as we were talking about earlier, happened in the state courts, even more so than the federal courts. And I found myself increasingly enmeshed in this body of case law that I found fascinating and I had never heard even talked about, much less studied by constitutional scholars. There's a real constitutional amnesia, I think, around this this episode in our constitutional history. And so once I found some cases finding anything like drug rights, then it snowballed, and I just kept finding more and you know, next thing I knew, I was deep into this period in American history and state and federal constitutional law, more than I expected. You know, there's more there than I realized at first.
So are you hooked? Are you going to keep writing about drugs?
I'm going to keep writing some about drugs. You know, right. The book is partly about drugs and drug policy, and I hope it's useful for people who care about drug reform. It's also very much just a new way to get a critical lens on American constitutional law and development and, the kind of stuff I write about a lot. But on drugs specifically, I do want to write about drug scheduling next and think about how we might do it better. Everyone seems to agree that the way we schedule drugs is crazy, you know, that marijuana is up there with the hardest drugs. And the one point that comes out in the book that is part of, I think, what would make for a more sensible approach to scheduling, classifying drugs, is that we're not taking into account the benefits that people feel they receive from drugs, which can take many forms. And everywhere else in administrative law and practice, when the government is deciding how to make a regulatory decision, you know, how much pollution should we allow from this set of companies, or, you know, what should be any area of public health, safety, and welfare, when the government is making these decisions, it weighs costs against benefits, right? It does cost-benefit analysis. That is just the bread and butter of the administrative state. And drugs are one of the only areas where we do cost-benefit analysis without taking into account the benefits. We just stipulate that there are no benefits here to consider other than possible medical ones. And we don't take into account the kind of what some call the hedonic, aspect here, the happiness and pleasure that people might feel they receive from drug use. And that's hard to measure and raises lots of issues. But in principle, I think drug policy is anomalous and indefensible in the degree to which it just acts as if the benefits don't count. And so I think a healthier drug scheduling regime would look much more holistically at the costs and benefits of drug scheduling decisions, and that's something I want to write about. Sorry, that was a long-winded answer, but just to say, I do think there's a lot more to say about drug law, but I'll also, I'm sure, turn back to my bread and butter of constitutional law and politics.
Well, I can't wait to read whatever you write about scheduling. That sounds incredible because scheduling is very opaque and strange and I think is in need of considerable reform. Well, we've taken up a lot of your time today, Dave, but I really want to thank you for this conversation. It's been incredible. I've learned a ton. And I highly recommend The Constitution of the War on Drugs to everyone. Go out and get it. Get copies for all of your family and friends. So thanks again for joining us today, Dave.
Thank you, Emily. It was great to talk and with a scholar I admire. And I'll just say, you don't even have to go out and get a copy. The book will be open access and starting really soon will be online for free as well. Something that I'm really happy about. So you can also just click on a link and read it online.
Amazing. We'll try to put the link at the bottom of the show notes for this episode. All right. Well, thanks again. And we hope to talk to you soon.
Thank you.